You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show...
Because they know that our dead colleagues wanted them to draw and to make laugh about those crazy, stupid guys who can kill for a cartoon.
With the first issue of Charlie Hebdo since last week's terrorist attack now on sale, we ask, are media outlets who chose not to publish the drawings cowardly? Sebastian Borgo and Ivor Gabe join me in the studio to give us their take. Also...
Some expect my speech to pave the way for a fundamental reform of the European architecture. I'm afraid they are in for a disappointment.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel addressed the British Parliament during her previous visit to London, but her recent trip was overshadowed by the events in Paris. We'll discuss the outcome of last week's talks and the transformation of what some are calling Angela the Hesitant into Angela the Decisive. And in the US, could Mitt Romney be headed for a third try for the White House?
I think this may be a
sign.
Politics is a strange thing. Because there's so much chaos out there, and Republicans believe, because Barack Obama's poor leadership on the international stage, that now is a time for an adult.
Former Republican Senator Joe Scarborough thinks so. We'll check in with Monocle's bureau chief in the US. We'll also check in with theatre critic Matt Wolff from the New York Times, who has just been to see the stage adaptation of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And as we head towards the final ever episode of Mad Men, Peter White from Broadcast Magazine gives us hints on what may be in store. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hill. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Al-Qaeda in Yemen has claimed responsibility for the attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. Gunmen killed a total of 17 people in 3 days of violence that began when they opened fire at staff in Charlie Hebdo's offices last week in revenge for publication of satirical images of the Prophet. One Western source said no hard evidence of a direct operational link to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula had yet been found, but this was the first time that a group officially claimed responsibility for the attack, led by two French-born brothers of Algerian extraction who had visited the poor Arabian Peninsula country in 2011. Meanwhile, the first run of the new edition of that magazine had already sold out in minutes, with a copy of the magazine now attracting bids of £100,000 on an internet auction site. Its cover shows a crying Prophet Muhammad with the words, "Je suis Charlie." Khalil Charles is from the Muslim Association of Britain.
We as Muslims support freedom of speech. However, freedom of speech cannot exist without some boundaries and without some common sense. And we feel that where freedom of speech is amounts to the right to offend people for the sake of having a laugh, for the sake of getting people outraged, I don't think there's a basis under which any freedom of speech should take place.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry has met the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Geneva on Wednesday to discuss possible progress on Iran's disputed nuclear program. Iran and six world powers have renewed their quest for an elusive nuclear deal after negotiators failed for the second time in November to meet a self-imposed deadline. The new deadline is the 30th of June. North Korea has firmly denied involvement with the cyber attack on Sony Pictures. Long-standing international sanctions have sought to push North Korea to end its nuclear weapons program, but while they have slowed the program, they haven't stopped it. North Korea's deputy ambassador at the UN is An Myong-hun.
My country has nothing to do with the Sony hacking. It is out of sense to do that, and we really want United States to provide evidence. We even requested to United States to undertake joint investigation. It is totally an out of established hostile policy against my country to impose any kinds of pressure against my country.
At least 10 people have been killed after a bus carrying prisoners lost control on an icy motorway and collided with a train in Texas. Officials said the bus was carrying 12 prisoners and three corrections officers from one prison in Abilene to another in El Paso. And staying in the States, a legal battle between the children of the late Martin Luther King Jr. over ownership of his 1964 Nobel Peace Prize medal and the Bible he carried with him during the civil rights movement has been heard by a judge in Atlanta. The feud pits his sons, Dexter King and Martin Luther King III, against his surviving daughter, Bernice King. The estate, controlled by the three siblings, had voted 2-1 to sell the items. Bernice voted against the sale. Dexter Scott King spoke outside the court.
The reality is that the items belong to the corporation. All of us as heirs, original heirs of Martin Luther King Jr., assigned all of our rights in our inheritance to this corporation. And one individual decided to sequester those items. And no one individual of the original five heirs had the right to do that. So this is really over making sure that things are back in their appropriate place.
President Obama even used Martin Luther King's Bible to take the oath during his second inaugural ceremony. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.07, that is 13.07 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news is Professor of Journalism at Sussex University, Ivor Geber, and London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, Sebastian Borger. Welcome both to the programme. First to Paris, where the first issue of Charlie Hebdo since last week's terrorist attack is now on sale. However, almost overshadowing the actual content of the publication are questions over whether the wider media has been cowardly for choosing not to publish the controversial cartoons. Ivor, if I start with you, media outlets exercise editorial discretion every day. Should this be any different case?
No, I think discretion's a good word for it. I think discretion involves both editorial judgments, but it does involve other judgments as well. I think there is a judgment about responsibility towards the safety of your staff. And I think some media outlets have played this, in my view, quite well. Not splashing the picture of the Prophet Muhammad full page, full colour, full screen, but not avoiding it. So it's featured in their news coverage. So, for example, the BBC had a shot of Charlie Hebdo being printed, and it was quite clear as the camera tracked that we could see and read the cover. Similarly, the Times printed the picture in the body of the report rather than as a separate picture. Now, you might call that a compromise. I suppose I do call it a compromise, but it seems to be a sensible one. There are other media that have refrained from representing it at all, and I think that's a failure of editorial judgment.
Sebastian, what are your thoughts?
I was amazed last week, on the day after the mass murder in Paris, that a number of British newspapers, amongst them respected titles like Telegraph and Times, refrained from printing any of the earlier cover cartoons of Charlie Hebdo, but instead they showed the moment that the Muslim policeman in Paris was executed. I thought there was a complete lack of editorial decision-making, a violation of this man's dignity, and I thought it was cowardly not to print anything at all. We always have to remember this is not an anti-Islam paper. It's a satirical paper which makes fun of basically everybody. And I think the papers last week that printed a number of cover cartoons of Charlie Hebdo, some to do with the Prophet Muhammad, some to do with the Pope, some to do with President Hollande, etc., got it right. Now, this week's edition, I can't see any reason not to print it.
Well, the decision of many media outlets not to release the cartoons, these decisions have sparked quite an outrage on the internet. Many have been calling on, for example, CNN to promote free speech by publishing them, and still these pictures haven't been published. Many other newsletters at the same time haven't wanted to release the cartoons. Ivor, earlier you made it clear already that you think that the decision not to publish any of these cartoons is basically a failure in editorial thinking.
It's both a failure in editorial print thinking. I also accept there's a certain, coward is a difficult word when you're thinking about the safety of your employees, but it's not a decision that covered the media in with great respect. However, I do think we have to be, you cannot be absolutist about freedom of expression. For example, I think cartoonists tread warily about, for example, the Holocaust. It is difficult to make fun of the Holocaust. And that's a point that many Muslim critics will make. So I do think, as you come back to what you were originally talking about, this notion of editorial judgment, I'm passionate about freedom of speech. As far as I'm individually concerned, I decided to retweet the cover of Charlie Hebdo because that was an individual decision. But I was not taking responsibility for 100, 200 employees. So I fear, and this sounds a bit weak, but I think these judgments about freedom of speech have to be tempered with other considerations.
Well, earlier today on the briefing programme here on Monocle 24, we spoke to Khalil Charles, who is spokesperson of the Muslim Association of Britain, and these were his thoughts on the new edition of Charlie Hebdo with Prophet Muhammad in the cover. Let's have a listen.
Ours is one of sincere disappointment, and in some respects quite appalled, really, by what we view is an opportunity that would have been for the newspaper to unite people rather than to divide. After the incidents of last week, whereby tragically 12 people, 17 in all, were killed, it would have been, I think, a great gesture if they had borne in mind that the people who went out and marched with them were the same Muslims that they're now offending.
So he said that this publication was a disappointment. He thinks that there was a missed opportunity to actually create some sort of further understanding. Do you agree or disagree?
I understand why he says that. I disagree, because I do think, as Conrad says, it would have been a complete failure. It would have been a betrayal almost of the millions who marched in support of Charlie Hebdo if they had not continued what they do. They go around offending people. I understand why the spokesperson for the Muslim Association of Great Britain is disappointed, but, you know, I get disappointed in many things. And I think that similarly, you know, a religious leader of the Catholic Church might be disappointed to see Charlie Hebdo having a cartoon of the Pope looking ridiculous. But that's what they do, and it's more important that they're allowed to do it than they're not.
Sebastian, your thoughts when we look at the situation? Tensions are still quite high after last week's events. Did we actually need this kind of cover that can be translated as further provocation?
I don't see it as a provocation. I'm sorry. I mean, this is, it's a satirical newspaper. Now, just imagine they had put the Pope on the cover this week. Or who else? I mean, can you think of anybody else? This is the topic of the day, and it's a very, I think it's a very sweet cover. It's a very well-balanced cover. It shows, you know, Je suis Charlie. I can't understand. And let's not forget that all these spokespeople represent very conservative strands of Islam. There are lots of other people who don't take offense, who are able to simply look away, who will say, under these circumstances, totally understandable.
Well, indeed, the first issue of Charlie Hebdo since last week's terrorist attack went on sale in France today. But those looking for a copy might be headed for disappointment, as Monocle's correspondent Tom Burgess Watson earlier today discovered.
Do you have any more copies of Charlie Hebdo?
No, no more copies. Zero copy.
Non, il n'y en a plus. Vraiment, il est fini.
épuisé.
Bonjour, il reste encore des exemplaires de Charlie Hebdo ici ?
Non, j'en ai plus.
Non, non. Tout était parti le premier 15 minutes.
Est-ce qu'il reste encore Charlie Hebdo ici ?
Non, no more. There was a huge queue at 6:30 a.m. Lots of people were here. We didn't receive many copies in any case.
What was the atmosphere like this morning when all those people lined up to buy a copy?
It was chaos. Lots of people had swarmed to the kiosk and we sold out immediately. Yes, it really was chaotic.
How many copies of the newspaper did you actually have?
About 10, but I'm not actually sure because there were just so many people.
Have you ever seen anything like that before in your career?
No, never.
So as you heard, Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson didn't manage to get a copy of his own, at least this morning in Paris. Predictions are that all 5 million printed copies of the latest edition of Charlie Hebdo will sell out. But what lies ahead for the paper? Ivar, after the dust settles and the debate fades, do you think this publication's brand of satire has a future?
Well, I think there is a long tradition of satire in France, and of course it has to be recognised that this was the junior partner, if you like, Canard Enchaîné, which sells over 250,000 copies, dwarfs Charlie Hebdo, is a commercial editorial success, if you like. In fact, as we know, Charlie Hebdo was in serious financial trouble. It had made an appeal for funds. But in answer to your question, yes, I mean, there is nothing now that will stop it from continuing for many years, because in the memory of the 12 people who died, they will make appeals for funds if they need it. But I think, all right, they normally sell 60, print 60,000. Maybe this week they sell 5 million. They're going to pick up a few more readers. They're good for the next few years.
Charlie Hebdo has been no stranger to controversy. Sebastian, how many countries does this type of uncompromising parody work in? What are your thoughts?
A dozen, maybe? 2 dozen? There are lots of countries where it doesn't work. And again, let's not forget this is a very fringe publication. You know, it wouldn't work in Germany. It wouldn't work here.
Private Eye is rather pale in terms of its attacks compared to it, although Private Eye tends to have more investigative journalism.
That's right.
That's a different tradition.
What makes a difference? I'm thinking about the Nordic region that I know rather well, and I know I can also say that Charlie Hebdo wouldn't work there. Why is that? Why wouldn't Charlie Hebdo work in the UK?
There's a French tradition, not just of printed satire, but if one thinks back to the theatre, one thinks back to the cinema. French culture has got this very strange bifurcation between high culture and vulgarity. One sees it, for example, in Moulin Rouge. One sees it actually in the work of the Impressionists, many of whom both combined high culture, if you like, with vulgarity. And I think it's a strand of French society, French life, which has been there a long time, which didn't develop or grow in the UK in the same way, and probably not in Germany either.
We have a nice satirical magazine called Titanic, and it has offended people, not least Catholics, left, right and centre, and was actually at one stage, I seem to remember, taken to court for it and may have had to pay some sort of fine. I can't remember.
But Private Eye gets taken to court frequently, but not for insulting people, but usually for libel, which is, I say, different, but in sense of making allegations against them rather than ridiculing them. It is usually successful and it is popular, but it is different from Charlie Hebdo. And, for example, United States, I think satire is almost non-existent. Well, having said that, I think of the television news shows which are satirical and are quite hard-hitting, but certainly in the printed word, there is little which compares.
Well, as we talked about in the beginning of today's programme, different media outlets have taken different approaches on how to cover this Charlie Hebdo story and what to publish and what not to publish. Do you think something will be learned from all this in terms of editorial judgment and editorial practices in the future either?
Well, I could be very pragmatic and say we are always learning things all the time. But I don't know what can be learned in one sense that if you as an editor or proprietor do not think it is worth the risk of being firebombed or attacked or whatever, then I don't think there's a lesson you can learn. You have taken that decision. The British media, which I've been following, took a mixed decision. Some of them published, some didn't. I think that will continue. What lessons to be learned more generally? Well, the lessons to be learned are difficult because the problem we're facing, in the West, is that we're not dealing with a organised threat. We're dealing with a mixture of lone individuals, disturbed people, but also people controlled by pretty desperate, well-organised grouplets who are directing them. And the whole thing is covered in a carapace of religious fundamentalism, and that is very difficult to deal with because one's not dealing with rationality, one's dealing with belief.
Sebastian, your thoughts?
I hope we learn to be a little bit braver. I thought, you know, having lived through the 7/7 attack in 2005 here in London, I thought we owed the French a gesture of solidarity. And the next day, the appropriate gesture was to reprint not a single cartoon, but to show the readers what Charlie Hebdo is about. And it's not about anti-Islam, but it's about anti-everything. And you need to show that on your front page rather than showing the execution of a Muslim policeman.
I think just one other point worth pointing out, thinking about the French tradition, is that they have a very strong tradition of secularism, of anti-clericalism, which we have neither here in the UK or in Germany. In the UK, we have an established church. And therefore, that does, and not, this is not a speech in support of the established church, but it does affect the way that newspapers and other media deal with these matters.
And before we take a break and continue with slightly different topics, final view from you. Earlier today, terrorist group Al-Qaeda in Yemen claimed responsibility for last week's attacks in Paris, saying that it was years in the making. If this is true, how will this change the way in which we view the attack on French soil?
I think we're seeing a bit of competition here. For the last year or so, ISIS, IS, call it what you will, has grabbed the headlines. I think that Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb or in Yemen has been relatively quiet in international terms, although it's certainly fighting ferociously in Yemen. I think that it will see this as a great success, and I fear it might well be planning other, what it would call, spectaculars. These are battles as much for propaganda and headlines as they are for territory, and they didn't like the way that IS was capturing the headlines.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, Sebastian Borco and Ivor Gaber. When we return, we'll discuss Angela Merkel's recent visit to London.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 21:23 in Moscow, 18:23 in London and 13:23 in New York City. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Ivor Gaber. German Chancellor Angela Merkel joined a rally in Berlin yesterday calling for tolerance amidst a growing tide of tension against Europe's Islamic community. She told the crowd, excluding population groups due to their faith or their origin is beneath the dignity of our liberal state. Hatred of foreigners, racism and extremism have no place in this country. These are strong words, but will it be enough to sway Germans' public sentiment? Sebastian Borg, what are your thoughts?
I've been surprised, as I think have many of my colleagues in Berlin, about the transformation of Angela Merkel, who, of course, a lot of political commentators in Berlin have recently called Angela the hesitant, or worse. And in her New Year's speech, she already alluded to these marches. You know that there, you may know that there have been marches in several German cities, particularly in the eastern city of Dresden since October, every Monday, by people who call themselves patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the Occident.
Also known as Pegida.
Also known as Pegida. Again, people said the Chancellor needs to have tough words about it. And Angela Merkel, as is her normal custom, stayed fairly quiet about it. And then in a speech said three sentences, basically said, stay away. These people have cold hearts. There is hatred there. Very strong words for someone who has made a reputation for being very restrained, for always looking for a consensus, for sometimes waiting to see where the wind blows and then following the crowd. So there is a very interesting transformation in domestic terms. Don't get that mixed up with her European or indeed global politics, which is still, I think, very careful, very restrained.
Ivar, how do you see Angela Merkel's current place?
Well, I do think that she now bestrides Europe, to use an unfortunate phrase. She has been the longest serving leader of a major European country. She's taken a very tough line in terms of austerity and the conditions that the European Union has imposed on Greece, Spain, Italy, etc. And to that extent, she's been a controversial figure. But in terms of her leadership, if that's the right word, of the reaction to the events in France, in terms of her very strong words against the rise of racism in Germany, I think she's been admirable. And I think that Britain, British people in general, now have quite a favourable view of Angela Merkel, which you can't say has always been the case with her predecessors.
Angela Merkel was in London quite recently on what was expected to be quite a high-profile visit. Just what exactly was the outcome of the Chancellor's discussions in London, Sebastian?
Well, if only we knew. Remember, she came here as the this year's president or chairwoman, whatever you call it, of the G7. She explicitly did not want to talk about Europe. Mm-hmm. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, insisted on talking about Europe, of course. And people kept asking me, well, what's she going to give him for his renegotiation? And the answer is she won't give him anything.
Didn't give much.
Mm. No, listen. People in Berlin can read opinion polls. There is a general election on in Britain in less than 4 months' time. There is a good chance that the opposition leader, Edward Miliband of the Labour Party, will be in Downing Street on the 8th of May, and she will have to deal with him. I think it's fair to say that she would prefer David Cameron to stay there in Downing Street. But and I'm sure there will be very interesting talks after that date, but not now.
When you look at where Angela Merkel is, the situation she is in at the moment, maybe the strongest leader in Europe, do you think she has this opportunity of actually achieving something she hasn't been able to achieve before?
Whether she sees it like that, I doubt. She is very much in the managerial mode of politics. I think she is. Last year, she's with the Ukraine crisis. She moved slightly away from that towards a tougher stance. But after long deliberations, after a very careful diplomatic process, where she tried to engage with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. I think she will be very happy if at the end of her tenure, whenever it is, she will be remembered as someone who held both Germany and Europe together. That wouldn't be a mean feat to have achieved.
And Ivan, my last question is for you about this unity. Now that we saw leaders from numerous European countries and also from outside of Europe marching together for solidarity in Paris, do you think all these events could actually bring European countries closer to each other.
It's a lovely thought, but I don't. I think the harsh realities of what's going on in the Eurozone, austerity, the sluggish growth, virtually non-growth in Europe, the difficulties that Britain is creating for the rest of the community. No, I think it was a moment, a fleeting moment, I'm afraid. And Europe and the European leaders and the European nations will remain, I think, because of economic reasons, for another 4 or 5 years in the doldrums.
We'll have to leave it there. Sebastian Borger and Ivor Gaber, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And it is 31 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. There's plenty still more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House, including a check-in with our bureau chief in New York. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. Al-Qaeda in Yemen has claimed responsibility for the attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. Gunmen killed a total of 17 people in 3 days of violence that began when they opened fire at staff in those offices last week in revenge for publication of the satirical images of the Prophet. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has met the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Geneva today to discuss possible progress on Iran's disputed nuclear program. North Korea has firmly denied involvement with the cyber attack on Sony Pictures. Long-standing international sanctions have sought to push North Korea to end its nuclear program, but they have not stopped it. And at least 10 people have been killed after a bus carrying prisoners lost control on an icy motorway and collided with a train in Texas. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. Jonathan will be back with more news headlines in about 28 minutes, just before this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to New York. Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, joins me now. Ed, welcome to the programme. The US election is still some time away, but the race for the Republican nomination is full steam ahead. It seems that earlier on there were some hopes for some fresh new talent, but now this hope seems to be fading. It may be that Mitt Romney is going to give it one more try in these elections. According to US media reports, Romney has been reviving his national network of political supporters and donors for a third run at the White House. Ed, is there much excitement in the air?
No, not really. I mean, it's kind of, business as usual. That's the sense. You know, this is an old name, a name that failed to win his party's nomination in 2008. Someone who secured the nomination in 2012, but then lost to Obama. So it's kind of like, well, you know, if he couldn't do it twice, what's to say anything's going to change this third time? I mean, obviously, this is, Romney is extremely wealthy. He can get a lot of funds behind him. But whether he has the ticket really to win is another matter altogether. Polls have shown in the past that he's kind of had this kind of, elitist air, an inability to connect with everyday Americans. And this is something, you know, the Republican Party wants to and needs to build on if it's going to have any chance of winning in 2016.
What is going on over there? After the previous presidential elections, it seems quite evident that the Republican Party was in the need for reinvention. At this point, it seems that leading contenders are old names, Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush.
Exactly. Obviously, the Bush dynasty huge. I mean, what's certainly true? I mean, there are two things. One is that the Bush name galvanizes a certain section of the Republican Party and Republican supporters. What Jeb Bush would say is that he's changed. He's not your average Republican. Actually, looking at kind of how he's changed over the years, he's kind of shifted his views on same-sex marriage. He's shifted his views on immigration. He now calls people who kind of walk across the border into the States from Mexico or other neighboring countries, you know, an act of love. But he's married to a Mexican, so he's got kind of slightly different. He's got slightly different views on immigration to other Republican candidates. And one has to remember that the Republican Party badly needs to win over immigrants or non-white voters. You know, they've consistently done badly in those areas. So perhaps Jeb Bush, being married to a Mexican, speaking Spanish, having different views on immigration to many of the core members of the Republican Party, might help them. But, you know, insiders stress that he, you know, retains core conservative values. So perhaps not that much of a change.
Well, yes. I'm just wondering, there's another one more past candidate who's still teasing with the possibility of running, and that is Mike Huckabee. Though he's nowadays attracting more publicity for his rather odd criticism of President Obama letting his daughters listen to Beyoncé. So essentially he's criticizing, yeah, Obama for allowing his children to listen to Beyoncé. How much do you think that connects him with the wider American audience?
I think, yeah, I mean, it's getting a lot of press here. I think this is the time of year when the rumor mill goes into full, you know, is in full force. Mick Huckabee is essentially an outsider. I mean, whether he's going to be one of the front runners for the Republican Party nomination, I think is highly unlikely. And so I don't think his comments had been taken that seriously. He called Beyoncé, who is, of course, extremely close to the White House, he called her lyrics obnoxious and toxic mental poison.
Well, if we leave that discussion now and move on to your other topics, something more serious now after Beyoncé. American view on the events of Charlie Hebdo. It seems that there's been a severe shortage of these newspapers on US newsstands as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there's all this talk of 3 million copies being available, and some have even suggested the figures have gone up to 5 million. What's certainly true is that it's not so easy to get your hands on a copy of the satirical newspaper if you're based in the US. In fact, the sole distributor, LMPI in the US, is talking of 300 copies available in the States at the moment, and all of them in French. Leading retailers like Barnes & Noble says it won't be selling it. Hudson News, which is an outlet available in rail stations and airports throughout the US, is saying it's making inquiries, but so far isn't stocking it. Same for the American Booksellers Association. So at the moment, much of the American populace would like to get their hands on a copy of this newspaper, at the moment not available, and we'll have to wait and see whether it's going to be translated into English and become more widely available in the coming days and weeks, Marcus.
Exactly. Charlie Hebdo definitely wasn't a widely known publication outside of France until last week. Are there expectations that the publication might continue with a wide American readership now?
I think we'll have to wait and see. I mean, obviously, the whole story has captured the imagination of the American public and obviously people around the world. So it's obviously much more well known than it was prior to the terrible events in Paris and the surrounding area. But we'll have to wait and see what happens. It really depends whether there's going to be an English edition going forward. Because if not,
exactly,
I'm not sure there'll be that many readers in the US.
And in other news, when I've been looking at what's going on in the American media, there's one quite nice story that is climbing related. Do you want to tell about that?
Yeah, an incredible story in the Yosemite National Park in California. These are two climbers, Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen, who've been climbing. It's called Dawn Wall. It's basically a sheer rock face of granite, 3,000 feet high. And they're trying to become the first people to do this as free climbers. Now, what that means is essentially, they have some rope for safety so that if they fall, they don't fall to their death obviously, and they have fallen several times during this climb that's lasted for 18 days. But they're just using their hands and their feet to climb up this sheer rock face. It basically doesn't really have any holes in it at all. I mean, if you were to look at it, it looks like a smooth surface. So it's quite an incredible achievement. And if they do it, it will be later today that they're due to reach the peak. And some quite incredible images that we've been seeing of them sleeping in these kind of suspended tents on ropes on the rock face. And just their hands that have been completely shredded from this incredible task of trying to climb this rock face. So quite an incredible story there.
Indeed. Thank you. That was Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York bureau chief, joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and up next we are off to the theatre.
Miami was all washed up, but then a brand new breed of art galleries and a boatload of art collections sailed in. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound finds out how this big bad city turned into a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed art town.
There's warm weather art here, sure, and flesh on show, why not? And there's the saleable big, bright and bold, but there's good art for sale too, things that mean things. This city's become a magnet.
Son of a Beach, the Miami art scene, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Fans of the Pedro Almodovar film Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown might have been anticipating the film's transformation into a stage musical. Well, should they be excited by the production's arrival on the West End? To answer that question, the international New York Times theatre critic Matt Wolff is here with me in the studio. Welcome to the programme, Matt.
Thank you, Markus. Lovely to be here.
It seems Broadway and the West End have been overrun by movie adaptations. And what is your view? How successful is this one?
Well, this is a little different. I guess it's an intention in that the movie itself isn't kind of an international brand. It's not like sort of Legally Blonde or whatever. It's a little more esoteric. It's, of course, very European. I think the subtitle of this show should be A Creative Team on the Verge of a Perpetual Nervous Breakdown, because when they first did the show on Broadway in 2010 in a production that I saw done in New York by Lincoln Center Theatre, so it was a not-for-profit context. There were lots of great names involved, including some real Broadway divas in the cast, like Patti LuPone, but the reviews weren't all that good and the show didn't have any sort of extended life. So they've treated this production like a chance to get right what they got wrong in New York. And what's weird is some of it is better and some of it is worse.
Let's start with where we see the improvements. What has been fixed?
Well, one of the things that's been changed, I don't know if I would say fixed, is that the New York production was very visually busy. There were lots of projections, there were special effects, there were aerial acrobatics for some reason that I don't quite remember. The London version is very simple, it's very streamlined. The set looks, it's a curved set that looks like it's taking place on board of a cruise ship for some strange reason. So at least what happens now is that you focus on the material, whereas in New York you couldn't quite see the material because of all the stuff going on around it.
And any other things that would have changed to better?
Well, of course, the cast here is totally different. And some of the actors who are in it here are very, very strong. I think certainly for British viewers and listeners, one of the great intrigues of this production will be Tamsin Gregg, who has the lead role of Peppa, who's a voiceover artist and actress living in Madrid, and she is kind of the central woman of these women on the rebound from her lover Yvonne, and it's her sort of existential crisis that sets everything in motion. Tamsin Gregg has never done a musical before, so when someone has never sung live, the question is, what are they like as a singer, and can they do it? And she's actually got a lovely kind of burnished quality to her vocals, and she's a much, much better actress than the woman who played the part in New York.
That's very nice to hear. Well, then, on the other hand, when you were watching this play, what were the moments when you felt bothered and when you noticed that something is not exactly working?
Well,
I'm sorry to say now, having seen it in New York and in London, that I'm just not sure it's one of those shows that naturally sings. Some movies lend themselves very kind of organically to being made into a stage musical. One thinks of The Producers, the Mel Brooks film, which became a very popular stage show, and I think was much better on stage than it was on film. There's something about this where the score isn't quite Latin enough. They don't know whether to make it feel fully, you know, like a Madrid experience, or is it all sort of imitation Spanish? And so they're kind of caught betwixt and between. There's an actor, Ricardo Afonso, who comes on strumming a guitar and has a very strong Spanish accent. And his accent stands out because he's the only one who's bothering to be authentic. So the whole thing seems at one remove from the material itself, I'm afraid.
Pedro Almodóvar is a film director known for his very distinctive and admired style. Do you think you saw some elements of this trademark directorial talent on stage when you were watching these performances?
Yeah, but perhaps not quite the way he would have intended. I mean, one of the things that Almodóvar's films make wonderfully plain is there's a kind of antic, manic landscape. Usually these women kind of scrambling to reclaim lost love or whatever, and it gives it a kind of giddy, anarchic quality. Here, it's antic and manic because you feel as if they haven't quite figured out how they should do it. And there are quite a few numbers where you feel them getting at what Almodóvar does so well, at his signature. Like, there's a great song in the show called Tangled, which is a wonderful image for Almodóvar's world, but it just isn't the showstopper it should be. You keep wanting the numbers to stop the show, and they don't, except near the end, Hayden Gwynn, who's the second female lead playing a character called Lucia, she has a great number called Invisible, and she bats it out of the park.
Matt, in the beginning you mentioned that for some reason it feels that this film just doesn't turn that well into a play. When we talk about films that have gone through this transformation earlier, are there any rules? What works and what doesn't? Why is it that some films work and some films don't?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to try to do is not just replicate the film scene by scene, line by line, shot by shot. The worst ever example of that was Dirty Dancing on the West End, which was a kind of horrific exercise in kind of just transcribing the movie scene by scene, which is ridiculous. To the credit of David Yazbek, the composer here, and Jeffrey Lane, the book writer, and Bartlett Shore, the director, they've tried to make this its own thing. But what I would do, if they want to do Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown Part 3 or Version 3, I would do it simply in a small theater, authentically and fully Latin, and that, I think, is how it will deliver best.
This business is really interesting. I do understand the temptation and will to turn films, successful films, into plays, considering that there is already a massive audience. If I was deciding something, I would probably want to have a James Bond 007 play in London,
yes,
or Lord of the Rings. They can't go wrong, can they? Or if they simply are bad, do you think they can still make money?
I'm chuckling, Marcus, at the idea of 007 on stage. Think of the special effects bill for that. The mind is reeling. Well, you know, there has been talk of Back to the Future, the musical.
Exactly.
That has actually been talked about. So watch this space. The thing about this is they're trying with London to get the show nearer to its source, which is Spain. So one thing you can say for it on the West End is London is nearer to Madrid than New York was, and I'll leave it at that.
Exactly. Thank you. That was Matt Wolf, the International New York Times theatre critic. You are with me, Dory House. ...1847 in London, 1047 in San Francisco. Coming up next, Peter White from Broadcast Magazine is here to give us a glimpse into the exciting year ahead for TV watchers, not least of which will be the final few episodes of Mad Men. Let's stay on that track now with the song heard by a hallucinating Don Draper in the last year's mid-season finale. This is The Best Things in Life Are Free, this time performed by Joe Stafford.
The stars in the sky, the moon on high, they're great for you and me because they're free. The moon belongs to everyone. The best things in life are free. The stars belong to everyone. They gleam, they're for you and me. The flowers in spring, the robin.
to everyone. The best things in life are free.
That was Joe Stafford with The Best Things in Life Are Free, which you might recall from a particularly wonderful scene in last year's Mad Men finale. Staying on the topic of Don Draper, let's welcome Peter White from Broadcast Magazine to Midori House. Welcome to the show.
Hey.
So, Peter, an air date has been set for Mad Men, and we already know that, well, it's going to end soon. Are there any clues yet on what we might expect from these last episodes?
Yeah, so the last season, season 7, has been split into two. The first batch of episodes launched last year, and there are the last few to come this year, starting on April the 5th. Matt Weiner, who's the show's creator, has said recently, in fact this week, that he's not going to pander to the audience, but that he does want to make sure that the ending is as good as some of the other sort of high-end cable dramas that have come before it, whether that's Breaking Bad or The Sopranos. There's a lot to come with Don, and there's a few things to tie up and loose ends, whether it's to do with women or his work or what's going to happen. We'll certainly see, and we'll certainly know in the next few weeks.
Well, Peter, can anything go wrong? I'm just thinking about that there must be quite a lot of pressure when we are talking about how to end this and what people are going to be remembering of Mad Men.
Of course, there's a very easy way of going wrong, and seen by The Sopranos ending with a lot of people thinking their TVs had just turned off rather than actually having a satisfactory ending. I don't think that's going to happen here. I think there's a few rumours going around. There's rumours that Don Draper might not actually be Don Draper, whether he's another character. D.B. Cooper, the man who flew out of an airplane after stealing $200,000, is one rumour, and his wife Megan, turning out to be Sharon Tate, was another. That's unlikely, but we're still likely to see Don. Whether he sort of takes off and lives a happy life is probably unlikely, but we'll still probably get a decent satisfactory ending.
Well, considering the massive audience figures, I could imagine there is temptation of trying to keep these characters alive somehow. Do you think there's any chance for a spin-off?
I think that's unlikely in this case. I know what you mean in terms of some of the bigger franchises, but I think because this is quite a niche cable drama, and it's done well everywhere on the sort of high-end cable platforms, but it doesn't really reach out, doesn't really break out. So I think in this case, we're not going to see Don Draper the early years or sort of some sort of 1980s Reagan-era Draper-style exploits. I think we'll see what happens, and that will be the end of it.
Well, Peter, let's continue with another hit series then, House of Cards. The trailer for season 3 was released this week. Let's have a listen.
You want to know what takes real courage? Holding it all together when the stakes are this high.
We're murderers, Francis.
We're survivors.
Well, as most House of Cards fans would agree, Kevin Spacey makes for an amazing US president, thankfully fictional. This show has been a massive hit, but Could it be the final outing for President Frank Underwood?
It's quite possible. It's gone at a very quick pace. If you remember, he was only vice president 1 year ago, or just managed to get himself to be VP. So the fact that he's now president through a series of sort of ludicrous schemes and things that him and his wife were up to, it could quite conceivably be the end for him. This series looks a lot darker if you from that trailer and a few other things. There's a Putin-esque character that's come involved. There's a few things to tie up, his chief of staff's death in the last season. So yeah, there's quite possibly the finale, without giving too much away, apparently was filmed in New Mexico and Las Vegas, so we could see some sort of famous spacey burnout in the capital of sin.
Do we know anything else what to expect?
I think we know that he's now got what he wants to get, really. I think the whole purpose of House of Cards, the US version at least, was that Bo Willimon created, was to get Spacey to this point of being the leader of the free world. So it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that, and whether some of the things that he did come back to haunt him, as to whether, as she says there, we're murderers, Francis.
I think it's interesting. I need to ask from you, by the way, now when we're talking about House of Cards and obviously also about Mad Men, when you look at countries where these have done particularly well, are there any surprises?
Whether there's surprises, I'm not sure, but House of Cards has done well. Remember, House of Cards has only really aired where Netflix has aired. So Latin America, it's done very well, and Scandinavia is a big hotspot. For Mad Men, it doesn't tend to travel to certain parts of the world. I'm not sure it necessarily breaks into Asia and places like that. But both of them have done well with upscale, you know, the whole line that people who make over $100,000 a year love these types of show, which is why they can carry on for quite some time.
Exactly, and when we're talking about that kind of audiences, have you noticed many other series around now that kind of try to do the same tricks as these two?
Oh yeah, I think the influence particularly of Mad Men, if not House of Cards, has been huge. If you look at the people now making TV, it was only the other day that Woody Allen has been announced to make his own TV show. A lot of people are trying to do these dark cable dramas, and there's a whole few things coming up, whether that's things like Fortitude, a sort of Scandi drama, or Battle Creek, which is another show by the guy who created Breaking Bad. They're all sort of this anti-hero isn't going away anytime soon.
Well, with Mad Men winding up, AMC is definitely in need of another must-watch show, and many hopes are pinned on the Breaking Bad spin-off. Better Call Saul is the name. Let's have a quick listen.
You will atone!
What can we do for you, Jimmy?
The money is beside the point.
Money is the point. Does this scream payday to you, huh?
You know, Jimmy, in our line of work, you can get so caught up in the idea of winning that you forget to listen to your heart.
Better Call Saul. Two-night series premiere begins Sunday, February 8th at 10. Only on AMC.
Better Call Saul. It's a great trailer, but it does have a distinctive familiar flavor to it. Peter, do you think there's a danger of this one feeling a bit like decaf Breaking Bad?
Possibly. That's the danger, isn't it? I think Saul Goodman was a great character in Breaking Bad, and Bob Odenkirk is an incredible actor. As to whether he can pull off an entire series himself, there was some great humor in the original character, and apparently this series is going to sort of focus a little bit more on the early years and how he sort of becomes this lawyer for hire for bad guys. AMC will really hope that this does well. They haven't got a great deal else, but I think with Vince Gilligan, the guy who created it, you really do think this will actually be quite well written and funny and dark in places.
How excited are you?
Oh, I can't wait. It's launching on February the 8th. I think if, as someone who took the day off work particularly to watch the finale of Breaking Bad, then I can't wait to do the same for Better Call Saul.
Well, if any speculation, if we can do any of that, what do you expect from that in terms of plot?
I think the big rumour is to whether Walter White or Jesse Pinkman turn up in this. I think there's been a few rumours that their characters might come into contact with Saul before their Breaking Bad moments. I think that's the big thing people will be watching out. Otherwise, it's going to be a sort of a pretty humorous case of the week, with Saul sort of looking at various strange characters that he'll have to represent. I think it'll be a bit more of a traditional show than Breaking Bad was.
That is fascinating. Thank you very much. That was Peter White from Broadcast Magazine. And that's all we have time for in today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Sebastian Borgo and Ive Gaber. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Ciacopelli. Then at 2200 hours London time in about 3 hours, it is time for The Monocle Daily with Ted Kravitz and Peter Cardwell. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.